Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head-on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Good evening and welcome live from the most beautiful city in the world, Houston, Texas. It is great to have you on this last Sunday evening in June. And look at this awesome sunset over the Texas Medical Center right down here at the heart of downtown Houston. And it's just beautiful. And I just love this view, and I love this town. I can't get excited enough about Houston and Texas. It's just a wonderful place to be. And right now, the Houston Astros are just absolutely knocking it out of the park on the baseball field. And we love that also. So hopefully it'll be a good year for them. But welcome to the program. We have an hour of just wonderful conversation tonight. And I always want to invite you to be involved. Although a lot of times you do Facebook, if you want to get on Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page right now, my wonderful son Curtis is right there watching and will comment back and forth with you if you have a thought, a comment, or a question. Or you can call straight in to the BBS radio station at 888-627-6008, and we would love to hear from you. If you have a thought, if you have a comment, jump in. We don't pre-screen the calls. We'll take you right away and take you in live right into the conversation. We want you to be a part. But this may be something tonight that you want to contact maybe someone that you may know of that has battled with child abuse, that has battled with alcoholism, that has battled with losing their spouse in a tragic way, watching them fade away, because our guest tonight is going to have a story that he's going to share with each and every one of you through the next 45, 50 minutes. Next week, I want to let you know on July 4th, next Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central, the oldest daughter of Robin Williams and Sally Field in the movie Mrs. Doubtfire. Curtis and I taped an awesome interview with her last week, Lisa Jacob, and she has written two wonderful books. She will be our guest next week. And to be honest with you, it's one of the best interviews I think we've ever had. We talked for about an hour and a half, and just a wonderful young lady. And her and her husband are going to be here in Houston come, I think, September, October, to work with some Vietnam veterans. And hopefully we're going to be able to get with her and help her with that venture, Curtis and I. But Lisa Jacob will be here next Sunday night. These are the two books. You Look Like That Girl, A Child Actor Stops Pretending and Finally Grows Up, and Not Just Me. And this book is about anxiety, depression, and learning to embrace your weird. And these both are excellent, excellent books. So you may want to get those in advance before that interview next week. But that'll be next Sunday night, July 4th. And we thought we would do, in honor of our nation's holiday, Freedom Day, is to talk about somebody that's making an impact with Vietnam veterans and PTSD. So we want you to be a part of that next Sunday night. And our guests throughout the month of July are just going to blow your socks off. So just hang with us and be with us. We appreciate each of you joining in with us each Sunday evening, 888-627-6008. And I would love to welcome to our program tonight, Gordon Clark. And Gordon Clark is a new friend of mine that we have talked over the internet and emails and via phone time after time after time. It's just been great conversation. And he is a survivor himself, an overcomer of child abuse and alcoholism. And he also is he likes to term this as a forever grateful husband of Lily Bella and the founder of something that we're going to talk about tonight, of the Bella Foundation. And I just want to welcome Gordon Clark to the program tonight. Gordon, can you hear me all right this evening?
I can hear you fine, Dr. Williams. Can you hear me?
You're perfect. Fantastic, Gordon. Good to have you. And where are you located at right now?
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor and a privilege to be here with you tonight. I am in Connecticut, Enfield, Connecticut.
Enfield, Connecticut. That's part of the country I don't think I've ever been to. Where is Enfield at in that state of Connecticut?
Well, Hartford is in the center of the state, and Enfield is north of Hartford, right at the border of Connecticut and Massachusetts. So I'm about one exit away from Massachusetts.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, welcome to the program. I know maybe you haven't done a lot of interviews, or maybe you have, but I think this may be one of the first few. So just relax. Two friends are just going to talk tonight. We're just going to let the whole world listen in. Is that all right?
That sounds good. Actually, this is my first interview ever on the radio.
Wow.
And I don't typically talk in public. The last time I did was about 15 years ago. So I can't think of anybody better I would like to share my story with than you. So as uncomfortable as it is for me, I'm just thankful to be here doing it with you. So thanks for the opportunity.
Fantastic. I appreciate you coming on. And I think the show, when we came up with the name of the show, I think it's perfect for your story of just kind of breaking the silence of what's happened to you. But before we get into that, I always like to just go with the flow. Tell me what it is that you want to spend the rest of your life doing. What kind of impact do you want to make on people? What do you think your purpose is for the next years that you have? Four decades, five decades, however many years you got left. What do you think your calling is to this world? What kind of impact do you want to make?
Well, that's very kind and generous of you to ask. I'm an individual who's always lived by purpose. And years ago, my purpose was, before I met my beloved wife, was to help my mother, who worked three jobs and was a single mother. And I was able to financially help her grow her business and become financially well off. And then my next purpose was, as the husband of Lily, was to take care of her, and did that for almost 30 years. But now with her recent passing, I really didn't have a purpose, and I didn't know what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And then one morning, I woke up in a jolt. Which is not normally the way I wake up. I normally wake up gradually. And it was about 6 months, a little bit more than 6 months after Lily had passed. And I heard, you know, the Bella Foundation. And I used to call my wife Lily Bella. And I knew instantly when that name came up what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And that is to hopefully take care of children, especially orphans. I think in one sense, we're called to do that, biblically speaking or scripturally speaking, to take care of orphans and widows, but also because Lily loved children. She lit up more around kids than at any other time. And so it's, I think for me, a dual purpose, in the sense I feel like I'm called to do it and I'm serving my Creator, but I'm also doing something in loving memory of my precious wife. So that's what I'll be doing. And actually, this shirt is, we'll talk about the Bella Foundation maybe later at the end, but this is the website that will lead you to more information about it if people are interested.
Fantastic. Fundbella.org. Wonderful. That's
right.
That's great to have that right there, so I can just keep mentioning, people can write that down and get on that and to find out more about that. How, Gordon, did we end up connecting? And that first call, I remember I was in a parking lot. I was driving, and I believe you sent an email. And I immediately pulled off the side of the road and called you. I believe that's the way it happened. I'm not for sure, but how did we connect?
Yes, well, I first heard of you about a year ago on a different program, and I immediately bought your book, but I didn't have the courage to read it. And I also was taking care of my wife, who was battling Parkinson's disease. And so I wasn't able to read it until after she passed. And I read about 6 or 7 books after she passed to help me through the grieving process. And your book was one of them. And I was just so moved by it, I reached out to you. And I couldn't believe that you actually answered the phone. And we had a nice long conversation, about an hour. And it was just wonderful. So I look forward to our friendship growing over the years.
Absolutely. No doubt about that. Well, tell me, when you read the book, because we're going to get into your relationship with your wife and a wonderful love that you had, and then the last days of her life and how that's turned into this organization that you're doing. But with your earlier life as a child, tell me, did anything in my story resonate with your story? Was there anything that happened to you as a child that you could relate with and go, wow, that you battle with, and how you handle those events in your own personal life?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot I share in common with you. I don't believe I was sexually abused, but I don't know for certain, but I don't think I was. First of all, I'd like to recommend everybody read your book. It's a wonderful book and a blessing, and I'm looking forward to your next book. But the main thing I would say that was similar to our stories is that what happened to me was always a secret as well. It was never talked about. It's primarily one of the reasons why I agreed to come on your show, because the title of your show, Breaking the Silence, is the way I try to live my life. I think embedded in that title, Breaking the Silence, is telling the truth. And most of us who have been victims of abuse, we hide it. Yeah. And we don't share it. And it goes on for many years, and it could lead to things like addiction and alcohol abuse, which almost cost me my life. So I share that with you, that the pain that you went through, and that there was nobody there to reach out and help you. And you really had to find a path on your own. And so it really touched my heart to read your story. And you are... I don't have a lot of heroes in this world, but you're one of my new heroes. So bless you for having the courage to speak about your life. And it takes a lot of courage to do what you've done.
Well, thank you for that. What was your pain, your own personal hurts and traumas by your father, too?
Yes, they were. And I was, bullied when I when my mother divorced my father, and I went to live in a different area in a different town. But the bullying was it was tough, but it was nothing compared to what my father had done to me. And I don't have a lot of recollection of what happened, because my mother divorced him when I was 4 years old, and I never saw him again and never spoke to him again. And he died in a car accident when I was 17 years old before I was able to look him up. Under the influence, apparently, of alcohol and prescription medication. So, but the little I know, because my mother just, doesn't like to talk about it, and I don't press her too hard for it, and I understand. I don't blame her at all. But and if there is any blame, I've forgiven her a long, long time ago. Yes, it was done by my father. And if you'd like, I can share, one or two stories that will give you an idea of the kind of abuse I endured and how it led to my eventual alcoholism, I believe.
Well, totally up to you if you want to nutshell it for us. But I would like to know how it did lead to the self-medication and the alcoholism that you did.
Yeah. But I'd first like to say that to your audience that when I speak of my father, I'm not in a negative way. I'm not condemning him. I long ago forgave him. And believe it or not, even though I didn't know him, I love him, which some people may find hard to understand. But I also want you to know that when I talk kindly of him, I'm not making excuses for him either. And what he did was not right. So to answer your question, My father was a brilliant man. He was a mathematical genius, some would say. He won gold medals in mathematics before computers, and he spoke four or five languages fluently, and he was a perfectionist. But he was also a terrible alcoholic and a terrible husband and a terrible father. And what I was told was, when I was younger, he hated the fact that I was left-handed, and he would call me evil for being left-handed, and not that I had any control over that. And so my mother would have to feed me before my father came home from work. And whenever he would see me doing anything with my left hand, he would berate me and so forth. And, but the more, you know, graphic, detail of how, abusive my father was, is, and I know that, not only from my mother telling me, but from the impact it had on me as I grew older, is that when I was an infant, my father threw me in the ocean water from a motorboat, and I didn't have a life preserver on. And my mother had to jump in to save me. And she was not a good swimmer. And she saved my life. I wouldn't be here today if she didn't do that. And I was so terrified of the water up until I was about 8 years old, that when my friends and family would go to the ocean and they would all go swimming in the water, I wouldn't even let my toes touch the water's edge. And I would carry a blanket with me or a towel with me. And if a drop of water splashed on my face, I would, you know, pat it off immediately. And one day my uncle, who is, may he rest in peace, he got tired of this, and he dragged me kicking and screaming into the water. And I had nothing to float on, and he pulled me in over my head, and I kept reaching to grab him, and he just kept going out further and further. And lo and behold, I started swimming. I started dog paddling. And after that, you just couldn't get me out of the water. Today, I could do all the strokes, breaststroke, butterfly, side stroke, you know, freestyle and backstroke, what have you. And you could throw me in the middle of the ocean and I would be, you know, comfortable. I love the water today. And so I have him to thank for that, and, you know, the father above for that. But that's the kind of trauma I endured from my father.
So when did you start recognizing, because your father obviously had left you, like you said, and passed away when you were 17.
Yes.
When did you start turning to something else to comfort you, to get you through maybe your own battles that you were dealing with? How did the alcohol work into your life as a child? Or was it later on in life?
Well, not as a child. You know, when I was 4 years old, I went to kindergarten, and I was so afraid that I used to stand on the teacher's foot, shaking in fear. I couldn't even talk back then. And one day, I think it was one of the first miracles in my life, the teacher called up my mother and said, something happened to Gordon today. He's completely changed. He talks, he plays with the kids, and he's happy. And so even though that was a great blessing for me and a great breakthrough, the healing was just beginning. And so I endured about 5-6 years of bullying, because my family was the only Asian family in our town. It was a pretty big town until I was in 11th grade. So I was called, it was in the middle of the Vietnam War. So up until 1975, until I was in about sixth grade, I was called, you know, every name imaginable, you know, chink, Jap, gook, commie, and rocks thrown at me, you know, physically, you know, assaulted and so forth. So, but by the time sixth grade came along, the Vietnam War was ending. And so some of that died out, and the bullies got tired of, you know, losing to me, I guess is the simplest way to say it. So they kind of backed off a little bit. And that was the first time I had my first friend in sixth grade. And he's been a blessing in my life ever since. We're still friends today, 45 years later.
Wow.
Or more. And, but the real trauma started to appear when I was about 12 years old, and I didn't know it at the time because I was only 12, but I started drinking. I was following in my father's footsteps, you know, and, I didn't know why I was drinking. I was just drinking. And, I'm not proud of it. Back then the drinking age was 18, but I was drinking. I started drinking at 12, and I actually started buying liquor at the liquor store at 13 years old, if you can believe it.
Wow.
So I didn't coin this back then because I had never had any intention, at least conscious intention of hurting myself or killing myself. But I was participating in drinking almost every day from the age of 12 to 17. And about every 6 months or more, I would drink so much, it should have taken my life. And so the first bout was when I was 13, I drank a pint of vodka straight in two gulps in less than 2 minutes. And then I went out in the cold in the winter and ended up in this brook, this shallow brook, fell face first into it, should have froze to death, should have, you know, drowned. My friend that was with me, he was so afraid, he just ran away. And I was told later, I don't remember this, but I somehow miraculously got out of the water and knocked on this stranger's door covered in mud and water. And they called the police and they took me home. And next thing I remember, I was waking up naked in my bed. And that was the first time. And I promised I would never do that again. I would never drink again. And within a couple of days, a week, I was back to drinking again. And within another 6 months or so or more, I would have another one of these types of episodes where I would drink so much that it would typically cost me my life. And then the worst one was when I was 17. So if you want to talk about that, I'll be.
We're going to do that just on the other side of this break as we get into this, because I want to make sure we don't cut you off in the middle of that 17, age 17 story. We're going to be right back after our first commercial break. We're going to find out more about Gordon and his battle with alcohol and as a youngster. And it's, you know, most of the time we get this story around 25 to 35 in that area, but we're talking about as a teenager. So we're going to find out more about that just on the other side of the first commercial break. 888-627-6008, or you can go right to this Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page if you want to comment or you have a question. We'll be right back with Gordon Clark after our first commercial break. Stay with us. Finally coming very soon will be the release of my second book in the three-part trilogy, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. Now, this book will be an in-depth look at the many different facets and emotions that a person goes through when they're experiencing anxiety and trauma in their life, and they're simply searching for hope. And an exciting addition to this book will be a companion journal guide that will come along with it. Also, there's going to be something that I'm very excited about, the youth version of this book called When Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. And it's going to be an excellent tool and guide for teenagers dealing with stress in their lives. So stay tuned for the release date coming very, very soon for these exciting new resources. Now back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams on the BBS Radio Network. All righty, I'm checking my text because we're getting a couple texts for some people that you're hitting a hot button with them, and that's always good. I can tell by my phone if anybody's actually listening because they start texting in and saying wow, or me too, or asking about this or whatever. 888-627-6008. We'd love to have your comments and your thoughts, and we're with Gordon Clark. From the wonderful state of Connecticut. And he's with us tonight, and he's sharing with us about the early years of being abused by his father, just growing up in not such a great family environment, and turning to alcohol. And how did you, Gordon, before we get to the 17-year-old story, how did you have access? Was you one of those guys with your 13 years old and you look 20?
Just the opposite. Really? Just the opposite.
How did you buy liquor? Or did you buy it from somebody else, a high school friend or something? How did you get your hands on it?
No, I did it myself. And I'm not proud of this fact, but and I certainly don't encourage anybody to do this. But, you know, when there's a will, there's a way, right? And I had been working since I was 9 years old. And my family wasn't rich, but I always had a pocket full of money. And so I learned early on that most people are motivated by money. So I got this fake a license, or this ID. It wasn't even a driver's license. It didn't look like anything like a Connecticut driver's license. And I had this baby face, and I walked into the liquor store. But before I walked in, I would take my cash and I would hold it in my hand, you know, flashing my cash. And I had, like, you know, this is back in the 70s, and I have, you know, $200 in cash in my hand. So it was a lot of money. And I would just walk in there like I owned the place, and I just start piling up, you know, six packs of beer, taking liquor off the shelf, putting it on there. And the owner would know that I had the money. I wasn't just making it up, because I had it right in my hand. And so I'd come up to to cash out, and he'd say, you're not 18 years old, because that was the drinking age back then. And I'd say, I give him my fake phony ID, and I, you know, wouldn't pass for anything today. And he knew it was fake. You know, and but it gave him the approval to take my money. And so he looked the other way, and he gave me sold me the liquor, and I was a regular customer of his.
So what happened? Was it a life-changing event at 17 years old, as you was getting ready to go into that part of it?
Yes, try to keep it brief, but you know, I almost died a number of times before 17, and about 6 months before graduation from high school, I had a vision that if I went to college, I was going to die, and because I was already at the edge, and I've already should have died multiple times, so it wasn't unrealistic to think that in college, you know, where there's really no, you know, constraints compared to high school, it was not going to be good for me. So I had this 17-year-old idea that if I joined the military, that somehow I'd be able to quit drinking. And I was so desperate to quit. You know, nobody knew I had this problem but me and the creator of heaven and earth. I never told anybody. Nobody ever told me I had a drinking problem. And it was, you know, clear to anybody who could see. But, you know, some people just don't want to see what's around them. It's just too tough to deal with that reality. And they just either didn't know how to help me either. So I joined the military, and thinking that, you know, this would do it, even though I was a disciplined kid. I'd been working since I was nine. I played golf and football. I, you know, didn't like school, but I, you know, did fairly well academically. And so I joined the Navy, not to see the world, not to get an education, even though I qualified for the two best schools the Navy had to offer, electronics and nuclear engineering. I just wanted to quit drinking. I literally just wanted to quit drinking, and I was willing to give up my freedom, my girlfriend, and just to give up drinking. So, make a long story short, about 4 weeks after boot camp was 8 weeks long, and so about 12 weeks into my time, I was in my first schooling, where you had to take 200 tests in about 8 weeks and get 100% on every test, and a couple of my new friends said, hey, let's go out and have a drink, and let's get a half pint of vodka and we'll share it between the three of us. And, you know, I wanted to fit in and be like the other guys. And so I thought, yeah, sure, why not? You know, it's only a half a pint. I could do that myself standing on my head. You know, I had a high tolerance for alcohol. And so anyways, my friend, just totally innocently, he didn't do this on purpose. I don't blame him in any way, shape or form. But he comes out of the liquor store and he has this big bottle with him. And I said, what's that? And he said, they didn't have that half pint of vodka, but I got this fifth of 151 rum. Now, I don't know how many people out there know what 151 rum is, but it's like drinking gasoline. It's like grain alcohol, and you're not supposed to drink it straight, and you're supposed to, you know, mix it in fruit punch. And I knew this. They didn't know this. And so I knew it was bad, and I actually vowed years before that I would never drink that stuff again. I actually knew what I was drinking. It was I drank an ounce of it a few years before that, and I was so hungover from 1 ounce that I said I would never drink it again, and there's no other liquor I ever said that about. So when this friend pulled it out of the bag and we went down to drink it, he touched it to his lips because he had never drank it before, and he says, I can't drink this stuff. It's too strong. And then my other friend did the same thing. He says, I can't drink this. And here I was, giving up my freedom and my girlfriend to quit drinking alcohol. And I grabbed that bottle and I guzzled half of it down straight. And then I took I don't chase anything when I drink. And I took the Coke that they had and I chased it a little bit because it was like drinking gasoline. And then I waited about another 10 or 15 minutes, and then I drank the other half of the fifth. Now, for people out there, medical professionals or other people who know what that is, it's 75.5% alcohol, 151 proof. And I should have died. You know, two or three people should have died. I didn't even have my stomach pumped after that. The last thing I remember was I was waking up in my rack covered in vomit. And I didn't even know my name. They say it's never happened to me before. They say I had wet brain. I learned this years later, but you get amnesia. You don't know who you are. I didn't even know if I had a family. I didn't even know who my mother was. So it was bad. I was in total fear. I thought my heart was going to stop at any second. And so we went back. My friends woke me up out of this and had to get ready for school. I cleaned myself up, took a shower, and I just followed what they were doing. And we went to school. And in this first class, you had to teach everything to yourself. We had a proctor in the middle of the classroom, and there was about 40 students. So I had my own little cubicle, and I just laid there for 3 days. You're supposed to take 4 to 5 tests a day. I didn't do anything. I couldn't even think, let alone read. And I just laid there, and I just prayed. And I just begged the Father in heaven to help me because I had nowhere else to go. You know, there's a saying that the creator of heaven and earth is not all you need until he's all you got. And out of just total desperation, and I had faith since I was a 6-year-old, but I never went to him for help. Even though I prayed every night, I never prayed for him to help me or deliver me from alcoholism. But those 3 days I prayed and I begged and he delivered me. And I know some people may find this hard to believe, but he took away my desire for alcohol. And about a year or two later, he spoke to me and he said these words to me. He said, "Gordon, do you know why you tried to kill yourself by drinking alcohol?" And I didn't think at the time, even then after I was sober, that I was trying to kill myself with alcohol. I didn't know why I drank. Had no clue. And so he said, "Do you know why you tried to kill yourself with alcohol?" And I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Because you hated yourself because you didn't have the love of your father." And I just sat back and said, "That sounds right. Yep. Thank you for telling me." And I knew right at that instant, I would never be drunk again. I would never try to take my life again. And next year, I'll be celebrating 40 years of sobriety and all by his grace, all by his grace.
That was the turning point?
That was the turning point.
So you stayed in the Navy?
Well, it's a long story, but I was honorably discharged. It was a great experience for me. I was supposed to stay for 6 years, but because I didn't, I went in there to quit drinking, and I'm thankful to the Navy for that, even though I don't know if they really had a role in it. I'm very grateful for my time there. But I was able to, because of my contract, to be honorably discharged from the service. And, because even though I was doing well in school, it just, I had no interest in the electronics or nuclear engineering at the time.
Okay. So do you think you were self-medicating, deadening the emotions of what had happened to you earlier in life, that the person that was supposed to love you and protect you was the one person that violated all those codes with you personally? So you think you were just trying to deaden the pain?
Absolutely. I think that was it. You know, when you don't, you know, as they say, if you don't, you can't love somebody else until you love yourself. And, you know, despite my smile, I didn't love myself. I didn't know that. You know, I was just a young kid. But when you're not given love at a young age, when you're victimized, when you're, you know, dare I say, hated, and I say this not lightly because, you know, my father, you know, his whole family was killed by Stalin, and he had a lot of guilt, and I don't make excuses for him, but he was in a lot of pain, and he, like me, drank his pain away, and yeah. he could not love me because he didn't love himself. And so I forgave him when I was 6 years old, but even though I forgave him, you know, long ago, it didn't allow me to heal my own brokenness until I finally was able to figure out why I was doing what I was doing to myself.
You know, I was talking to somebody the other day online in another state that I have no idea what their name was, but she had mentioned that I cut myself, and I said, help me understand what you're doing. Cause I don't have that. I never experienced that. Although I did things to offset the emotion and to take my mind off my own pain. And she said, well, doctor, it's the same thing. The more I bled, the less I hurt. And it's like, why? That doesn't make sense. Because I think about my own self-inflicted pain, not the pain that I had experienced as a child being abused by somebody who was supposed to love me. So your alcoholism was doing the exact same thing. You're doing this to prevent and deaden the pain of what had been done to you as a child.
Absolutely. And I think, unfortunately, what a lot of people don't understand is that, you know, just because you grow older and you become, you know, well-educated and you can talk and you can think, if you're traumatized when you're young, emotionally, you become stunted to a great degree. And so when you hurt yourself, either knowingly or unknowingly, you do it with a childlike mind. It doesn't make a sense to an older teenager or an older adult. But that individual who's been traumatized when they were young, they're thinking emotionally like a child. And so we have to put ourselves in their shoes to help them get out of that stuck position so they can mature and be healed. And a lot of people don't want to go into that dark place in the past. But to go forward, I have found you need to go back in that dark place. You have to break the silence, as you like to say.
Yeah, that's excellent. I tell you, I think what we're going to do, let's go ahead and take our last break, because on the curve of this now, I want to talk about your relationship with your to-be wife and how the love happened, what the experience that you have with her diagnosis and how that ended and how that turned into what kind of love you're having for her being portrayed on with the Fund Bella Foundation and the fundbella.org. So we're gonna do that on the last segment after our final commercial break, and join us. Be right back, 888-627-6008. And we'll be right back after this final break. Hang with us.
From HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back, live from Houston, Texas. We are with Gordon Clark from Connecticut, and he has just told us in the first two segments about him and his childhood and all the way up to being out of the Navy. And I really want to spend the rest of our time, Gordon, what you're doing to help others, but how you got into that mode of finding your wife, falling in love with her, and what kind of impact she had on your life, and how that process worked and the marriage that you had, and then her drastic diagnosis and the final days of that. So I'm just going to let you tell us about the story with Bella.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to do that. I'll try to summarize it as well as I can in the time that we have. I guess the best way to describe my relationship with my wife, actually, I'll offer to your audience a written 15-page testimony of my wife at the end, if anybody's interested in more detail.
And this is wonderful writing. This is just wonderful. I encourage everybody to, if they want to get this and reach out to you on that. I would highly recommend that.
Well, thank you. So I would just, maybe to simplify things, I would describe our marriage, our relationship in four words: uncommon, unbreakable, and eternal love. And uncommon because she was a lot older than me. And so therefore our families weren't exactly in favor of that. And unbreakable because the lack of support, and I think partially because of our age difference, but also because of my ethnicity, some people were not exactly thrilled about me marrying Lillian. But so we endured not only our own trials and tribulations in every marriage that every marriage has, but we had to overcome a lot of familial lack of support, to say the least. And so that's why, and through that fire, our relationship became unbreakable, we believe. And we used to have a little joke that when we would get through one of these difficult times, we'd say we're still together. And my wife would do a little dance when she did that. And then eternal, because I believe that love goes on. I believe that someday, by his grace, I'm going to be with my wife again for eternity. And that's my hope and prayer. And so that's how I describe our marriage. The 15-page testimony will give you a little bit more insight into that. But if you don't mind, in that light, I would, what's not in the testimony, I don't like to repeat myself. So I'd like to share something with your audience that may be a blessing to them, especially to the men in the in your audience. You know, most of us are taught as men that, it's unmanly to cry. And personally, I never cried. I can't remember crying until I was 35 years old. And I endured a lot. And when my father died, I didn't cry. I still haven't cried to this day for him. And I've never been afraid of crying. I just wouldn't cry. And, we were told, only the good emotions could be shown in our family. You know, like most families, nobody likes to deal with the sadness and the hard emotions. And so when my grandfather was sick in 2000 with cancer and I knew he was going to die, I told my wife that I don't think I'm going to cry at his funeral. Because I didn't cry when my father died. And, I love my grandfather. So on his deathbed, he didn't speak English. So I asked my mother to interpret, and I told her to tell him that he was the most courageous man I've ever known. And I told him I loved him. And he, according to my mother, told me that he loved me too. And he had never said that before. And I'd never said that to another man before either. And so I started crying a little bit then. And then on my way home that night, I started really crying, weeping. I thought I was going to have to pull over on the side of the road. And then I went home and wrote his eulogy, which I didn't think I was going to do. And I wept and sobbed. And then when I delivered it, I sobbed. But it didn't really change my life after that. I loved him. I visited him just a handful of times over the years at the cemetery, but it didn't really change my life. And then when my grandmother passed away 4 years later from Alzheimer's, I loved her even more. And I thought, I'll handle this even better because now I know how to handle these emotions. And I handled it better, and I did her eulogy too, and I wept publicly and privately, but I definitely handled it better. So when Lillian was, you know, suffering with Parkinson's for 11 years, and she was getting closer and closer to her last days, as much as I hoped that she would live forever, I thought I'd handle it pretty well. And I certainly would cry because I loved her more than anyone. And I'd weep and I'd do her eulogy. But when she passed away, it was like my heart was ripped in half. It was, I know it's hard for some people to believe because they may not have gone through it. It was hard for me to believe. But I felt like my heart was ripped in half. It was just 100 times worse than my grandmother passing or my grandfather passing. And I literally thought I was going to die. And I was very blessed that when I was planning my wife's funeral, within a day or two after she passed, this wonderful woman who worked as a emergency room nurse, who I'd never met before, and that was my rawness and my emotion was just pouring out of me. And I said something like, maybe it would have been best if I stayed single and never met Lillian and never married her, because it seems to me that it's better to have not loved than to have loved and lost. Mm. And she said these profound words to me. I'll never forget it. And it was the beginning of my healing process. She said, and she heard this from a paramedic, you know, these people see death all the time. Yeah. Yeah. And he said, the price of love is grief. And at that moment, instantly, I knew why I was in so much pain, because I knew I loved my wife, but I never recognized how deeply I loved her. You know, people say that you don't know how much you love somebody until you lose them. And that is certainly definitely true for me. And so I knew that the pain I was feeling, I could now understand the pain I was feeling because I'd never felt anything like this before. And so although it took, you know, about 6 months for me to finally work through my grief, that was the beginning process. So I would encourage, as you do in your show, especially men, to share their pain and not be afraid of crying, because that's how the healing process really starts.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So after she passed, how did you deal with that? Emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually? And then how did the idea come from, hey, I want to, in honor of her, to create this foundation that you believe in and started now?
Well, my wife, like me, had a very rough childhood, and it's probably one of the main reasons why we bonded. And she was so honest with me about her pain. And so we were both abused as children, and but she was so strong, and yet she wasn't afraid of her feelings, where I was always trying to suppress my feelings and say, you know, feelings are not that important, you know, let's move on. And she was not having that. You know, she would tell me about how she felt, and then she would deal with it, and then she would move forward. She's a very productive, very hardworking woman. And but she didn't, she wasn't afraid of talking about her pain. And so I know from her experience how the tragedies in her life, and they're in my testimony, my written testimony, partially about what she went through as well, and what I went through with my life, that this foundation to help children who have been traumatized when they're younger, especially orphans who have lost a parent due to death. She lost her, my wife lost her mother, for example, at 18 months old, and her unborn baby brother. They both died when she was 18 months old because her mother, her uterus ruptured when she was giving birth. And then my wife's first stepmother died when she was 4 years old from tuberculosis. And then her second stepmother abused her for, you know, 4 to 5 years, and until the father found out about it and divorced his second wife. So my wife had a lot of trauma and other traumas as well. And so I know the pain, as she did, about what kids go through. And she loved kids so much, and she always wanted to help them. And even though I don't have kids, and I knew I wouldn't have kids when I married Lillian because she was so much older than me, I love kids. And so I can't think of a better thing to do with the rest of my life than to help kids who are orphaned and or abused or, you know, live in poverty in some way and don't have enough food to eat. So I'm really excited about the foundation, and you know, by His grace, it'll produce a lot of fruit, and it'll help a lot of children.
Now, if people want to find out more about this Bella Foundation, is this the best way on the front of your shirt, the fundbella.org?
Absolutely. If you go to just fundbella.org, there's just a one button there that links to the GoFundMe page, and you can read a little bit more about myself and my wife. And if you can make a donation, great. Any amount is great. I'll send you a copy of my 15-page testimony about my wife. But if you can't afford anything, just hit the contact button and email me if you still want a copy of the testimony, and I'll send it to you for free. And if there's, you know, something that besides, you know, monetary resources that you think could be of help or service, that you have some gifting or have some thoughts or ideas on the Bella Foundation, I would be happy to talk to you about that as well. So if you want to know more, just go to fundbella.org and click on that button and contact me or make a donation or request a copy of that testimony.
Yeah, this is really good reading. Gordon, did you ever have an opportunity to talk to your wife about something like this in the final days of saying, hey, hon, this is what I want to do? Or is this something that came in to your mind after that you just wanted to do in her honor?
Yeah, it came in after about a little more than 6 months, as I said, when I woke up from a sleep abruptly. But my wife, you know, when I married her, I insisted that she stop working, that she retire shortly before we were married. And because she'd worked so hard all her life, and she wanted to go and work at a daycare. And I wouldn't, you know, would not give her my blessing, to say the least, because I didn't want her to work. And she just always wanted to be around kids. And I remember years ago, she would watch the television, and she'd watch this show where women were giving birth, and they were screaming, and there was blood. And I was, I can't watch this. And my wife would be just beaming in joy. And I'm like, how can you watch this? These women are screaming in pain. And yet she was so emotionally strong that she knew that through that pain, the baby would be born. And when that bundle of joy would come out, blue and purple and covered in blood, she would be so happy, like it was her own child being born. And I just was so amazed that she had so much love for people that were not even her own. You know, years ago before I met her, she was asked by an African-American single mother to be the godmother to her little boy. And she willingly accepted. And she then, it wasn't just a name. She would take him to the beach, and she would take him on day trips up in New Hampshire. And, you know, they eventually moved away from the area, so they lost touch. But my wife, you know, she didn't have a racist bone in her body. She, you know, she loved me, you know, so part Asian, part, you know, Russian. And she just was just such a wonderful person. She just, you know, loved every child. And I don't know if you know this, but, you know, I had a lot of little names for her, but she, in the last couple of years of her life, I started calling her Lily Bella. And I'd always ask her permission if she liked those names. And I knew the first time I used that name to her, I don't know why I didn't say it earlier, but because she's Italian, she knew what Bella meant. And Bella means beautiful. And my precious, beautiful, you know, wife, she was told when she was younger that she was ugly and that she wasn't beautiful and that she wasn't pretty. And no matter how many times I told her she was, she really didn't believe me. But, you know, it took time, but she eventually started to believe me.
That's great.
And so when I told her she was Bella, she knew that it made her happy. And I think she thinks every child is beautiful. I believe the same thing. Every child is a blessing, and every child is beautiful, no matter what, you know, color, skin, size, it just doesn't matter.
That's great. Gordon, I tell you what, we're out of time, but I appreciate you being on so much. If somebody wants to get in touch with you, is the best way through?
Yes.
Website fundbella.org. They can contact you straight through that.
Yeah, I made it real simple for everybody, and there's a contact button on there, so you can send me an email, and if you'd like to get in contact. So love to hear from anybody who has a great passion and love, real genuine love for children, and would like to help children.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And Gordon, it is an honor to be on the board, the advisory board, or however, whatever board you want to call that for this organization. I'm looking forward to many years working with you to get that to where you want it to be, to help as many people as we possibly can. So if you want to help out, if you want this awesome testimony, fundbella.org. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. They're telling me my time is out. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Blessings to all of you. Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it, Gordon. As we always do every week, we always want to just let you know, no matter where you're at, no matter what's happened to you, no matter what's going to happen to you this week, there's always hope. Join us right here next week with Lisa Jacob from the Mrs. Doubtfire movie to find out more about her life story next week for another edition of Breaking the Silence. God bless. We'll see you. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.